Hello, I'm Tom Sito. This is number 0317, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0317. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, actor Robert Palmer Watkins, who plays Dylan Quartermain on General Hospital. He had to hit the ground running entering the world of daytime drama.
I give soap opera actors so much credit, and I had no idea the amount of dialogue you have to learn in such a short amount of time. And then you get on set and you do blocking, you go to hair and makeup, you come back up, you do your take, and then you're done. And you're lucky if you get two takes. Usually you get one take. I mean, it is so fast paced. You just got to be prepared and ready to go. I mean, I'm learning so much. I'm learning. It's like actor's boot camp. It really is, because you go in there and it's like, if you can get through being on a soap opera, you can pretty much do anything, I feel, because it's just so much dialogue, so quick.
Neil Gibson, founder and editor-in-chief of the UK comic book company TeePub. He took a leap of faith to create his comic book world.
It was a passion project. I didn't actually expect to be where I am today. I just had this free time, and my friends and family were back in the UK, and I wanted to try writing a comic just for fun. I thought I'd just see what happened. And then the response was so positive when it came out, that's when I realized I had a dilemma. Because I actually liked my job, and it paid very well. Or I could take a risk, and I knew that there isn't that much money in comics. Like, the film Avengers made more money than the entire comic book industry did that year. But I really loved them. So if I took the risk, and it paid off, it meant every single day of my life was a holiday because I get to work in comics.
Edward Myers from Ripley's Believe It or Not is back on the show with their latest book, Eye-Popping Oddities.
It really is a very, very visual book. There's over 1,000 great photographs. Page 22-23 is my absolute favorite picture in the entire book. It is a circus employee playing with an elephant. The elephant has his head in its mouth, and he's lifted the guy right off the ground about 3-4 feet high and is holding on to him by his ears. I just love this photo. And the guy's name, Frank Cheerful Gardner. That says it all. He likes to have some fun at his job.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff. And, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0317 was Disney animator Tom Sito, who is also the author of Moving Innovation, A History of Computer Animation. And we had him on the show just about, 3 weeks ago or so, talking about his book, which again is called Moving Innovation, A History of Computer Animation. Thank you very much, Tom, for doing the guest Slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Number 0317, as you heard Tom mention, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, as someone who lives in Montreal, I'm used to hearing everybody complain about potholes in our city. The condition of our roads is far from best, to say the least, and there are always complaints about the slow or ineffective efforts by the city to fix the problem. Well, as bad as it might be perceived here, that's nothing compared to Jackson, Mississippi. The streets of Jackson, Mississippi apparently have potholes that rival the worst in the U.S., but without adequate budget to fix them, according to Mayor Tony Yarber. His remedy, offered earnestly to constituents in August, was prayer. Yes, prayer. I believe we can pray potholes away. That's what Yarber said, who was elected in 2014, by the way, and he actually is also a pastor at the Relevant Empowerment Church. I'm guessing if Yarber continues on this path, as a mayor, he'll soon be irrelevant and no longer empowered. But that's just a guess in my case because, you know, the Lord does work in mysterious ways. However, I don't think he fills potholes. Yeah, Anyway, a thief grabbed the purse of an elderly woman shopping with her husband at a store in Spokane, Washington, back on July 23rd, and fled through a parking lot. Now, they had no chance to catch the man, but he happened to run past a hospital nurse, a woman by the name of Heidi Muat. She's 42 years old, by the way. And Heidi surmised the situation and started after him. The thief quickly saw that Heidi could outrun him and gave up the purse, which Heidi returned to the couple. Now, Heidi later revealed her alter ego. She is one of the Spokannibals. That's a roller derby team. And she is known on the team as Ms., and I will spell her name for you, I-D-A, B, period, C-H-O-A-Z-Z. That's Ms. Ida Beachoaz. Ida Beachoaz. Literally, you go, girl. And Norwegian TV viewers have somehow given strong ratings to a series of seemingly interminable programs. One of them, a continuous camera on a salmon fishing vessel. 12 hours of live log burning, complete with commentary. And, you know, I've done commentary on a lot of things in my radio career, but I can't imagine doing 12 hours of live commentary watching a log burn. Also, 5 hours of knitters spinning their way to a world record, 100 straight hours of chess playing, a 5-day stretch from a cruise ship. Those are just some of the things people in Norway seem to like to watch on their television. What a docile bunch, huh? In August, they were presented with another such gift. The Norwegian caviar company Mills said it would live stream on a YouTube channel nearly 11 months of fish eggs aging 24/7 in barrels. That's 7,392 hours of programming. Wow, these people know how to live. If they ever got to watch the Kardashians or Honey Boo Boo in Norway, I think their heads would explode. Yeah. An Arizona homeowner foiled two teen burglars with a samurai sword after coming home early in the morning and finding them inside his home. One of them, a 16-year-old male, fled the scene. The homeowner used the sword, known as a katana, to detain the other teen, forcing him to wait on the couch until police arrived. Deputies took the 15-year-old into custody and later arrested the second teen. One of the teens showed deputies where he discarded a backpack used during the burglary. The backpack contained about $900 worth of items taken from the house. They are fortunate that in this case it ended this way, with them just being arrested, and that they were not injured by the homeowner, who came home to find them burglarizing his house, according to a Pinell County Sheriff's spokesperson. You know, I'm sure that teen sitting on the couch didn't take his eyes off that nice shiny sword for a second while waiting for the cops. He was probably more happy when the cops arrived than the homeowner was. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, want to hear a story about a really twisted family? Really? Here we go. Police in Oakland County, Michigan, say a man was stabbed by his father-in-law after finding the 47-year-old man nude in bed with his wife, the man's own daughter, if you're paying close attention to this story. The 25-year-old man told police that he arrived home and discovered his wife and her father completely nude, laying together in bed. The man woke up his father-in-law and got into an altercation that continued outside the home. That's when the older man, since identified by police as Henry Allen Michael of Detroit, allegedly stabbed the younger man in the back with a knife. After stabbing, Michael got into his son-in-law's vehicle and fled the scene. Boy, you take a man's wife, then you take his car. That's really crossing so many lines, isn't it? Anyway, after interviewing the victim, deputies located his wife. The 24-year-old woman told police that she and her father were out drinking, and when she arrived back at the house, she passed out. She did not know what had happened until her husband woke her up, police said. The woman told police she has reason to believe that she was sexually assaulted. Michael, who was staying at the couple's home after being released from prison for robbery and assault with a dangerous weapon, was later arrested and is lodged at the Oakland County Jail on pending charges. Okay, so we can establish from his history that Dad's a piece of work. Now, if you were a betting person, do you think his daughter had to convince her husband to let her dad live with him after coming out of jail? And do you think that's a future constant I told you so argument that will last for a while in that marriage dynamic? Yeah, me thinks so too. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? Fans of General Hospital should know Robert Palmer Watkins. He recently brought back the role of Dylan Quartermain, who had been off the Port Charles landscape for a while. Robert joins us on the line right now from California to talk about his career and his relatively new role. Hi, Robert.
How's it going, guys? How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So you have been playing the role of Dylan on our TV screens for, I guess, since early June. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yes. I started filming end of April, and my first episode aired June 5th, I believe.
So what was it like taking over what was initially an iconic role that had been around for a while? Was it any easier because there had been some time between you and the last person, Scott Clifton, who played the role?
Right, yeah. You know, it's crazy because a recast is always an interesting scenario because you never know, you know, if the fans are going to be open to a new actor playing the role, and Scott Clifton was so amazing at the part, and you know, I think what helped was it's been long enough. It's been, you know, like you said, 7 years since he was on the show, so he would have changed over time. He's more mature now, and he's been away for a while, so I think it made sense in a way for a new actor to kind of take over the part, and thank God it was a new actor because it gave me a role, which is always nice. Did I answer your question?
I don't really know
what your question was. I'm going to be honest.
Absolutely. going into the role, when you first got it, what did the producers tell you about the direction the character was going in? Was it a collaboration between you and the producers as to what you were bringing to the character, or it was just basically you had orders to follow here?
You know, it was interesting because they kept it very secretive. The whole auditioning process, I had no idea it was for Dylan. It was a secret name they had on all of the sides that I did for the audition. The character name was Dustin. So I really didn't know, even after the screen test, until I got the call that I booked the role, they didn't tell me that it was Dylan Quartermain. So, which was probably a good thing, because I think it would have been hard to not compare myself mentally to the other actor, you know what I mean? And I would have been tempted to watch his work, and I think that might have messed me up, because you don't ever want to get what he did, I'm not going to do, because I'm a different actor. So it's probably better that I brought my own choices to the table and didn't have anybody else's work in the back of my head. Once I found out that I got the role, I talked to the producers and the writers, and I had to catch up on all the storylines. And, you know, the show has been on for 56 years, a long time. So there was a lot of history that I needed to catch up on. And, you know, there's a lot of people that Dylan's related to and has dated and has had relationships with. So it's been an interesting process, and I'm still finding out things about Dylan. Every time I'm on set, I learn something new about Dylan. So, I definitely talked to the director, and I talked to the casting director, Mark Teschner, who is amazing. And I go up to the writer's office whenever I have a question. But they just really wanted me to, you know, keep the good qualities that everybody loves about Dylan, his humor, his sarcastic wit. But, you know, he has a good heart. And I think he is. He's a good, at the end of the day, he's a good guy. But they did tell me that, you know, he's grown up a little bit. It's been 7 years. He comes back. He's a little more mature now. He's a little more grounded. And as you saw in my first few episodes, I come right in and I kind of have this big confrontation with Luke. So, you know, I had to be a man. I'm standing up for my mom, and I just had to have a very clear point of view kind of on where I am in life now.
Okay. So
yeah.
So you have two situations here that I want to bring up. One is it must have been a daunting experience, A, when you realized you nailed the gig, the job is yours, you're going to be on the iconic General Hospital. But then after that, right. They tell you, oh, by the way, you're Dylan Quartermain. It must have been like a double whammy.
Oh, man. I really can't put it into words how amazing it's been. I mean, I've been a struggling actor for a really, really long time, and this is the first, like, big break that I've gotten. And, overwhelming doesn't really do it justice. It was insane. I mean, when I got the call, I felt like a crazy person. I was laughing and crying and screaming all at the same time. And then to hit me with Dylan Quartermain, which I have to be honest, I didn't grow up watching soaps. I didn't know a ton about all the characters, but I knew the name Quartermain. So I knew it was good, you know? And then as soon as I started researching the character and all of that, I realized, whoa, this is a huge deal. I couldn't have asked for anything more. It's just been so great.
So are there people in your life, family, friends, who, because you say you weren't familiar, you weren't necessarily a big soap watcher, but was there anybody who, when you said, I'm playing Dylan Quartermain, you could see the reaction because they knew who the character was?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My aunt, I said it to my aunt, and I thought she was going to pass out. I mean, my aunt watches soaps, and my grandmother watched General Hospital religiously also. So I definitely have family that was very familiar, and they filled me in on all the details of Dylan Quartermain. But that's when I started realizing how big of a deal it was, one of other people's reactions. You know, as soon as I say Quartermain to somebody, they go, "Oh, you're a Quartermain?" You know, and it's like, it's pretty cool.
So we know who Dylan Quartermain is. Tell us a little bit about who Robert Palmer Watkins is.
Robert Palmer Watkins is a white guy living in L.A. I'm an actor. I grew up in Salisbury. I was born in Salisbury, North Carolina. I lived there until I was 6 years old, and I moved to Winston-Salem, North Carolina with my family. And then my dad got a job with AMF Bowling, and the corporate office for them is in Richmond, Virginia. So we moved to Richmond, Virginia when I was 12. And that is where I did my first play in high school. And I got hooked. I loved it. And I auditioned for a Center for the Arts high school. I got accepted, so I did a theater program there. And then I went to college for a year and a half, and I majored in musical theater. And then I decided, you know what? I just really want to be in New York or L.A. I really want to pursue this, and I want to be out there. And I see kids that are my age doing it, and I can do it. So I convinced my parents to let me leave college. But they said, you can leave, you can go to New York or L.A., but you have to go to school. You can do a conservatory if you want for acting or music, but we want you to get a degree or some type of certificate. So I said, okay, cool. So I auditioned for the American Musical and Dramatic Academy up in New York. I got accepted there, and they have a campus in L.A., and they have a campus in New York. So I chose to come to the L.A. campus because I wanted to pursue TV and film. And, I've been out here ever since. I went to that school for 2 years, and then I've just been auditioning and living on couches and in my car and moving from apartment to apartment, working waitering jobs and bartending, and finally, it's paying off.
Well, that's one of the things people never understand about the business, and that is that there's a once you commit to it, there's a lot of cases a difficult road to travel along. During that period of time, like you say, when you're living on couches and living in your car, did you ever say, maybe this is not for me, or did it just drive you on harder to reach your goals?
You know, I never. It got really hard, I'm not going to lie, especially this past year. I was coming to the end of my rope, but I knew that I would never give up. I don't know why, but there was just something inside of me that I knew that I had to keep going. So I don't think I would have ever given up, but it was definitely driving me crazy. I think this past year, a few months before I booked this, my car broke down on the interstate, and I took it to the guy that's a mechanic, and they told me that it was dead. And that was just like, I had the worst week. I found out that I did not book another big acting job, and I was just so tired of it. It gets so exhausting. And then I found out my car was dead, and I was just like, man, I don't know how much longer I can do this. I don't know. I knew I was going to keep doing it, but I didn't know how I was going to keep doing it. You know what I mean? Because it's just so mentally, physically, emotionally draining. And it's really hard to not take the rejections personally. It's very hard to do that. So I was on the phone with my family and my mom and my dad, and I was like, I don't know, guys. Maybe I should just come home for a few months, up some money, and then come back out. Maybe I just need a break. I wasn't ever thinking about quitting, though. But my family was like, no, you can't come home. That's just going to be a crutch. If you come home, you might get stuck here. You got to keep going. You got to keep going. You're meant to do this. And then a couple months later, I booked it. So I'm glad I listened to them, you know?
That's a great story right there. A great story right there.
Yeah.
Now, the just got about a minute. Now you know, another great story. You're now on General Hospital. A lot of actors don't realize, or a lot of the general population don't realize that daytime acting is some of the hardest acting to do. I mean, you've got so many pages of dialogue. It's a daily grind where you're doing five shows. You're filling the airtime of five shows a week. There are no repeats. Did you really have to hit the ground running when you started playing the role of Dylan Quartermain?
Absolutely. I mean, it is crazy. I've been in a lot of independent films and commercials and some modeling stuff and little TV stuff. And I give soap opera actors so much credit, and I had no idea. I mean, the amount of dialogue you have to learn in such a short amount of time, and then you get on set and you do blocking, you go to hair and makeup, you come back up, you do your take, and then you're done. And you're lucky if you get two takes. Usually you get one take. I mean, it is so fast paced, and you just got it. I mean, these actors are just prepared. You just got to be prepared and ready to go. I mean, I'm learning so much. I'm learning. It's like actors boot camp. It really is, because you go in there and it's like, if you can get through being on a soap opera, you can pretty much do anything, I feel, because it's just so much dialogue so quick. So yeah, I'm just grateful. I mean, all the cast that I work with is amazing, and I'm just learning. So I'm just trying to soak it all in.
Well, welcome to the world of daily soap operas, and congratulations on being Dylan Quartermain. Thank you very, very much, Robert, for taking the time to be on the program with us. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, man, so good to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Robert Palmer Watkins, who plays Dylan Quartermain on ABC's General Hospital. You can find General Hospital on your television sets Monday through Friday, as it has been since 1963. Check your local listings.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to the founder and editor-in-chief of T-Pub Comics. Plus, Edward Meyer is back on the program with us. He's from Ripley's Believe It or Not. He'll talk about their latest book. We do, of course, have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on the show. Plus, much more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, If this story sounds familiar to regular Stuff File listeners, it's because almost the exact same thing happened a couple of years ago. Police in Waco, Texas, pulled a loaded handgun from a woman's vagina after a traffic stop led to a drug bust, according to officials. During the stop, officers found 2.7 grams of methamphetamine and arrested the driver. While being transported to jail, the suspect reportedly told an officer she had a Smith & Wesson 22 caliber semi-automatic handgun lodged inside her vajayjay. A female officer who retrieved the gun, how'd you like that job, huh? Reported that the weapon had a round chambered and a full magazine of bullets. The woman was charged with unlawfully carrying a handgun. Well, you know, Texas is a concealed weapon state, so if she had a license, she might have gotten away with it because, I mean, you can't get more concealed than that. And while out drinking with her boyfriend, a woman confessed to him that she had an affair with another man. 26-year-old Justin Michael Klum of Pasadena, Maryland, went into a rage telling her, "Someone's gonna die tonight." He drove her to the man's house, had her wait in the car, and allegedly set fire to the man's house. The man wasn't home, but his family was. It's unclear whether any were injured, by the way. Klum took a break to visit a methadone clinic, then returned to the house to, yes, take selfies in front of the burnt-out residence. The unnamed woman called them fire selfies, and police haven't released them as their evidence to support the charges against Klum, which, by the way, are attempted first-degree murder and first-degree arson. No need for selfies. The jailer, by the way, is more than glad to take photos of this clown himself. This is just another case, by the way, where a moron with a cell phone is simply selfie-centered. And speaking of which, here's another moron with a phone. 29-year-old Jordan Toner was driving in Orient, Maine, when his two front seat passengers decided to take a selfie. Toner leaned in to be included in the photo with the two ladies and ran off the road into a tree. This according to the Maine State Police, which investigated the crash. The two women were not seatbelted and thus ended up with the most severe injuries. Toner was cited for failing to maintain control of a motor vehicle due to being distracted. Again, selfie-centered. Wave of the idiotic future. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, pardon the vernacular, but many people have been pissed off while on a passenger jet. However, very few have been pissed on. An Oregon man is facing charges after authorities say he urinated on passengers during a flight from Anchorage, Alaska to Portland, Oregon. 27-year-old Jeff Rubin was arrested after JetBlue Flight 47 arrived at Portland International Airport. A police report says passengers and airline employees told officers Rubin had been sleeping for most of the flight. About 30 minutes before landing, he stood up and began urinating through the crack between the seats in front of him onto the passengers sitting there. The report says he lost his balance and fell backward, spraying urine on passengers' seats and luggage. Ooh. Rubin spent about 5 hours in jail. He faces charges of criminal mischief and offensive littering. Wow. There are very few cases of littering that could be more offensive than that. Anyway, let's get to our next guest, shall we? Neil Gibson is the founder and editor-in-chief of TeePub. That's a British comic book publisher and driving force behind such titles as Twisted Dark, Tabitha, Tortured Life, and the World of Chub Chub. It's a company that launched in 2011. Neil joins us now via Skype from the UK. Hi, Neil.
Hi there, how you doing?
Just tickety-boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us. So how did this come to be? Because you didn't start off in the world of graphic novels or comics, did you?
No, I did, not at all. No, I was a science background. I really love good comics. It's been a passion of mine. Actually, I first discovered them in Canada. I was living in Vancouver at the time. And in the UK, comics were regarded as childish. If you're reading comics at 14, you're old to be reading comics. And so I wasn't really reading them. And someone gave me Watchmen in my early 20s, and I just loved it. I couldn't believe how much it made me think. So I'd been a fan of comics for many years, and then I was stuck on a project in the Middle East. I had some free time, and I tried writing. And strangely, people liked my writing. They liked my comics.
So it's one thing to say that they like your writing. As you say yourself, you know, growing up in the UK, above 14, you don't really read comics. So did you think you were going into a business that was fraught with peril? First of all, what did you come from? You were in a successful world, were you not?
Well, I was a management consultant. I used to help companies improve their bottom line.
So a person who knows how to help companies improve their bottom line, you're going into a company that doesn't have a bottom line in a lot of cases.
You're absolutely right. It was a passion project. I didn't actually expect to be where I am today. I just had this free time, and my friends and family were back in the UK, and I wanted to try writing a comic just for fun. I thought I'd just see what happened. And then the response was so positive when it came out. That's when I realized I had a dilemma, because I actually liked my job and it paid very well, or I could take a risk. And I knew that there isn't that much money in comics. Like, the film Avengers made more money than the entire comic book industry did that year. But I really loved them. So if I took the risk and it paid off, it meant every single day of my life was a holiday because I'd get to work in comics.
Now, when you say you write comics, are you just writing, or are you involved in the artwork yourself as well?
Illustrating requires talent, so I don't do that. I'm involved with the writing, but I also am heavily involved with the editing. Because I genuinely love comics, I actually lecture a lot about it at schools and universities about how comics can help you in your business and in your career and in your studies.
Well, how can they help you in your business and your studies?
I started using them in my consulting background to get simple points across, because with comics you get a much stronger memory retention. Like if you look at your brain, only 3% of the neurons in the brain is devoted to hearing, whereas 30% of the brain is devoted to vision. Like the retina itself is an outcrop of the brain. So I'm sure if you've you read a book, suddenly you've got to the end of the page and realize, oh, I don't know if I haven't been taking any of this in. With comics, that rarely happens, because your memory recall is much higher with visual images.
Okay.
It's just effortless. So if you communicate, so what we made for this company once was they had a problem with their production department and their maintenance department. The production department had to keep building roads, build, and they wouldn't release the equipment to the maintenance department. So the result was there was so many breakdowns and downtime, which was actually negatively affecting the company. So we made a simple comment, servicing equipment and it breaking down and taking even longer to fix. And they stuck that in every single machine in every office. Production always started to increase, to release equipment to be maintained properly, and the downtime rates plummeted using a simple comic book. Similarly, if you're going to do for studies, if you're trying to memorize facts, if you draw little pictures for yourself, your recall will soar, because it's so much easier to remember images than it is to remember just facts in your head.
Interesting. So when you first started writing, because one of the things one has to figure out when they're a writer, regardless of whether it's comics or traditional literature, is you have to find your own voice. So how did you, someone who's never done this before, how did you go about finding your own voice?
It was mostly through fear, actually. Because I was a new writer, I was terrified of being boring. There's nothing worse than a boring story. So I felt that if I wrote stories that were quite dark and creepy and a little compelling with a bit of mystery, it'd be easier to avoid being boring. And that's how Twisted Dark came about. It's all dark stories with twist endings.
Ah, okay. Okay. Now, I mentioned the titles. You just mentioned Dark, Twisted Dark. There's Tabitha, Tortured Life. I got to ask, what is the world of Chub Chub?
That's a bit embarrassing. It was never actually meant to be a comic. It was just a gift to my mother. Because I wasn't the best kid, so these are all true stories of what I did as a child, which she finds really funny now. She didn't find them funny at the time. And she found it so funny, I made this thing for her. She insisted I release it as a comic. So I improved the art and released it. And people do like it a lot, but it is very different from my other stuff. So I like a particular author or director, I buy everything they have. I'm warn people, like, read the free samples before you get this, because it is very different. Because it's just embarrassing stories of my childhood.
Now, when it comes to the audiences, because I understand you get an opportunity to travel various places to Comic-Cons everywhere and talk to fans and meet other writers and the like. When you travel around, do you find that the audiences for comics or what adults like to call graphic novels differs from culture to culture?
Oh, absolutely. First off, if you take the Benelux region, France and Belgium, they really respect comics way more so than they do in the UK. The equivalent of the New York Times will every week review the best comics that came out that week. That would never happen here yet. I'm hoping to change that. If you go to the Scandinavian countries, the most popular comics by far tend to be Disney, like Donald Duck, which is surprising, and not the Marvel type of comics. Same in the in France again. Marvel superhero comics aren't that popular. It's more the bande dessinée format. So people have different tastes wherever they go. But that's just a great thing because you just get to discover different comics in different areas. Because whenever I go to these different conventions, I try and find out what the local tastes are and try and get English translations.
While you were growing up, what kind of comics were you interested in before you actually got into the business of comics yourself?
I read when I was really young, like the Beano and Dandy, which is really aimed at preteens, and it's a very UK. Anyone in the UK would have heard of it. After that, I kind of got into American ones, superhero ones, but then I grew out of them. I felt I grew out of comics before I discovered that comics can be tell any story, and it doesn't have to be just superheroes.
And for your comics, the ones you put out at T-Pub, what is the audience you're looking at as far as age group, for instance?
Well, actually, our philosophy, our mission is to get more people reading comics. So we're trying to release different titles. Our tagline is comics for everyone. So whenever we're at a show, for example, I love it when there are people who haven't read comics before. And so I ask them what TV shows or books do they like. And based on their preference, then I recommend comics to suit their taste. And if, for example, they like romance comics, well, frankly, we don't make them yet. So I recommend some other great comics that do that. So it's twofold. Our audience, I don't really pigeonhole or target market because I think a comic should be for everyone. But I appreciate that people have different tastes. So I just try and find out what their tastes are and then recommend content to suit that.
Do you find we're going back to an age of almost, let's say, 100 years ago? And the reason why I say that is I'm combining comics also with animation. When people read the newspapers and comic books in the 30s, it wasn't always kids who were reading the comics. When people watched cartoons like Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck and the like, they weren't made for kids. They didn't become a kid's staple until television showed them later on. They were trailers to movies that only adults were watching in the movie theaters. Do you think that we're going back to a time where an adult can look at a comic book and go, yeah, I read comics and I'm adult, so what?
Well, I'd love that to happen. That's what we want to do. I think that in North America, that pretty much is already the case. There are millions of adults who do read comics and don't feel ashamed about it, quite rightly. There are other parts of the world where that isn't the case, and that's what I'm hoping to change. In terms of it going back to that, I don't know, but I hope so. I'm hopeful.
Where can one find your comics?
www.tpub.co.uk. And we've got a whole slew of free stuff there for people.
So it's www.tpub, T-P-U-B as in Bob, .co.uk, correct?
Correct, yes.
And do you find, can people find anywhere in the world, can they find your comics in traditional stores as opposed to just online?
Oh, they can now. A few months ago they couldn't. We've just got international distribution and we should be in bookstores next month, actually, in North America.
Excellent. Neil, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program. Glad to hear somebody is following their passion and finding some success with it.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Neil Gibson, founder and editor-in-chief of T-Pub. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0317, and you'll find their website plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the comics directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. For many lawyers, being elected as a judge is viewed as reaching the pinnacle of one's career. And for most judges, being given a seat on their state's highest court is the greatest professional achievement they could ever earn. So when a state Supreme Court justice in Michigan recently announced she would retire nearly 20 years before the mandatory retirement age, it was very unusual. Justice Mary Beth Kelly serves in the court's majority, has never been involved in a scandal, and received the most votes of any candidate when she ran for the Supreme Court. She's respected by both plaintiff and defense lawyers. So why retire? She says she wants to go into private practice where she can promote alternatives to litigation. She says, and I quote, "There's a better way than traditional litigation to resolve disputes." End of quote. Let's be fair. When a top judge who has heard hundreds of lawsuits says there's a better way to handle our disputes than by suing each other, that's something to think about. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the latest tome from the folks at Ripley's Believe It or Not. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. Stick around for that. But right now, I got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, Vermont State Police say a man caught going more than 100 miles per hour was on his way to court, wait for it, to take care of a speeding ticket. Investigators say they received several reports of a car going over 100 miles an hour and weaving in and out of traffic on Interstate 89 northbound. Troopers say they clocked 33-year-old Seth Tichenor of West Hartford going at 112 miles per hour in a 65 mile per hour zone. He was arrested for excessive speed and negligent operation. Police say that Tichenor told them he was headed to traffic court to take care of a speeding ticket. Gee, you think perhaps it's time to just get this guy off the road? I mean, clearly, there's no lesson learned here. None whatsoever. You know, I could have made him the idiot of the day, but no, that comes later. But first, before we get to that point, let's just get to our next guest, shall we? The folks at Ripley's Believe It or Not have released their latest book. This one is called Ripley's Believe It or Not, Eye-Popping Oddities. And back to talk about this latest edition is Edward Meyer, the VP of Exhibits and Archives from Ripley's Believe It or Not. Hi, Edward.
Hello, Peter, and hello, Montreal, my second favorite city in the whole world.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, so I actually have this one in my hand right now. And first of all, right off the bat, the cover literally is eye-popping.
Well, and that's where the title comes from, obviously. The first couple pages, we have stories of people that can dislocate their eyeballs, literally push them out of their eye sockets. I guess we got one, two, three, five different people featured. And we thought that this was such a dramatic view that what if we did our 3D lenticular photography on the cover of eyes that looked like they were popping out. And once we did the visual, we said, well, why not call the book Eye Popping? And I think it's a perfect name for not just the stories on page 10 and 11, but for the entire book. There's stuff here that's going to make you stare.
Now, I'm sure you must have realized at the time when you put this book together and talked to people about their eye-popping prowess that you probably found out that this is not as unusual as it may sound. And I know this only because one of my four older sisters used to terrorize me as a child by chasing me around the house with her eye dangling like that.
Well, boy, I don't know how to comment on that. I guess I'd have to say that, you know, you're a fortunate guy to have a sister that's special.
She's special,
all right.
For the
longest time, we were only aware of one gentleman that could do this in the entire world. So we thought it was extremely rare. In doing the research, we found a few others, but I'd still say this is, you know, somewhere in the 1 in 100 million sort of category. So if you know someone, in your case, your own sister, it's a pretty rare phenomena.
Well, the one thing I can say about my sister is she's definitely special.
There you go. She's unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Now, we've had you on the program on several occasions, year after year, as a matter of fact, and these books come out each and every year. First of all, over the years, in its current form, which is a great big coffee table book, how many years have you put out these annuals?
This is volume 12. All the same shape, 9 by 12, 256 pages. Back in 2001, we developed our own publishing company. We've been in the book business since 1929, but we always had someone else publishing. And we made a conscious decision that we were going to do it ourselves. And, well, it was some people in England, give credit where credit's due, said, you know, you can publish as many books as you want, but you should have a signature iconic book that comes out every year, and people, you know, will want to buy it for Christmas and be waiting for it. So we took that advice 12 years ago, and it's a September release. Today is day one. Up till now, you may have found it in a Ripley Museum, but as of today, you should be able to buy this wherever fine books are sold. And it's been very successful for us. We still do several other books per year. Last year in total, we had 17 different titles, but this is where our focus is. We have a staff of about 10 that spend the whole calendar year. You know, the second they finish one, they start on the next one. So it's a full-time job for about 10 people. And the material is, for the most part, there's some archival things, but for the most part, it's new, current material, and all of it is new to our books. It's material we have not published before, even if it's a story that, you know, might be about something 100 years ago. So brand new content, year in, year out, kind of the best that we could find for the calendar year 2014, 2015.
Okay, so besides people who can dislodge their ocular orb, what else can one find in the book this year?
Well, a little bit of everything. Let me just start with a few of my favorite pictures, because it really is a very, very visual book. There's over 1,000 great photographs. And you know, your audience and yourself know by now that as the archivist of the company, I kind of like old things in black and white, so I'll just give a couple of those first. But page 22-23 is my absolute favorite picture in the entire book. It is a circus employee playing with an elephant. And it looks like he's in a lot of pain, maybe great danger, but it really is all for fun. The elephant has his head in its mouth, and he's lifted the guy right off the ground about 3-4 feet high and is holding on to him by his ears. I just love this photo. And the guy's name, Frank Cheerful Gardner. That says it all. He likes to have some fun at his job.
I'm looking at that picture right now, and I'm thinking, you better hope that elephant is cheerful. Wow.
Keeping with black and white just for a second, I think maybe the weirdest story, weirdest photo in the entire book, page 234, we got a guy in Australia standing inside the rotting corpse of a whale. And he is under the belief that this is going to cure his rheumatism. And it is just such a bizarre photo. You just see a little bit of his head peeping out from this big gray blob.
Well, it'll
definitely
either,
shocking, definitely eye-popping.
It'll either cure his rheumatism or ruin his sense of smell, which, by the way, is something else that might happen to the guy with his head in an elephant's mouth.
There you go. Yeah, guess he's going to need a shower for sure, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Going to a little newer, but staying in Australia for a second, page 71, we got a saltwater crocodile that is wrestling a shark. Now, and elsewhere in this book, we've got another pretty neat gator picture, but, you know, we've seen the pictures of gators fighting snakes, trying to swallow a deer, but this has got to be a first. Absolutely, you know, captured and is chomping down on a shark. Who thunk it?
Now, you mentioned...
It says they suspect that this crocodile, in this case it's a croc, not a gator, but in this case they believe the croc is 80 years old.
Wow.
And he's missing part of his front leg and most of his teeth, yet he's still brave enough to attack a bull shark.
Now, you've mentioned two items already from Australia, and that was a question I wanted to ask. Is, generally speaking, is there a part of the world that is more ripe for the kinds of things that show up in Ripley's Believe It or Not, or is it literally evenly spaced globally?
Well, is there a right answer here? I think that our weirdest stories come from China. India is probably high up there. And if we come to America, I have absolutely no doubts that it's Florida. I don't know why. I joke and say maybe it's the heat or the humidity or something that people go a little silly. But I don't know. We get more than our share of Florida and China, and they seem to be the hotbeds. But Montreal gets in there once in a while. Let me think here. I think we got three stories. Page 80, scientists at McGill University discovered that some species of fish that are capable of walking can change their anatomy and learn to walk more efficiently. After being kept permanently on land for less than a year, the African fish with air-breathing lungs allow it to walk on land to reach water, mastered the art of walking with its head up and fins closer to its body, also developed stronger and more elongated shoulders to support the body while walking. So good to know the scientists at McGill University are studying African catfish.
Okay, now whether... Whether the oddest stories come from China, India, or Florida, do you think the reason is just, you know, population or culture?
Oh, boy. I would like to think that it's mainly culture, but, you know, population might have something to do with it, too. You know, for years I lived in Toronto, and don't hold that against me. But, you know, we always thought when I was in Toronto that California was the strangest place in America. But now that I live in Florida, I think it's Florida, but close behind it would be Texas and California. So I really think heat might have something to do with it.
You may.
And, you know, in terms of China and India, I have to think population has a big part of it. More people... not necessarily more people doing strange stuff, but more people knowing about it, finding out about it. It's not quite as hidden if you've only got a little town of 10 people or if you got a town of 1,000. Somebody becomes more aware of what's going on. It gets more publicity, and it gets into the paper or onto the web, and, you know, Ripley finds out about it in Orlando a couple days later. And
well,
I don't know. It just seems like there's a cultural element in India and China that they want to be in record books. They want to do something that makes them different from everybody else.
Well, this the title says it all, Eye-Popping Oddities. How can one get their hands on this latest edition of the Ripley's Believe It or Not, the great annual books that you have out?
Well, literally as of today, should be in stores everywhere, Amazon.com. Ripley's.com sells it for a little bit cheaper than other stores do, and any Ripley auditorium around the world sells it the cheapest of all. So if you can visit Ripley's, Charlottetown, PEI, or Niagara Falls, Ontario, you'll save a couple bucks. But virtually anywhere books are sold as of today.
Edward, thank you very much once again for being on the program. Always a pleasure to have you on.
Always my pleasure. Thanks very much for having us.
Edward Meyer from Ripley's Believe It or Not. The latest book is Ripley's Believe It or Not, Eye-Popping Oddities. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0317, and you'll find links to Ripley's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Police in Massachusetts said an officer is facing prosecution after he allegedly fired his gun at his own police cruiser and burned it to stage a crime scene. Millis police launched a manhunt after an officer reported a white man in a dark pickup truck had fired shots at him while he was driving, causing his patrol car to spin around, crash into a tree, and catch fire. However, Sergeant William Dwyer said investigators determined the officer's own gun was used to shoot the holes into the police cruiser. "We have determined that the officer's story was fabricated," Dwyer told CNN. Specifically, that he fired shots at his own cruiser as part of a plan to concoct a story that he was fired upon. The officer was identified as Brian Johnson, a rookie part-time officer who was scheduled to begin training soon for a position as a full-time Millis police officer. Johnson was placed on paid administrative leave pending his official termination. Police are seeking charges of misleading a police investigation, providing false information to emergency services, malicious destruction of property, and unlawful discharge of a firearm. Okay, never mind the far-fetched story he told investigators, which is a whole new level of idiocy. Just the fact that he used his own gun and later his service revolver to shoot his car, never thinking that investigators would retrieve the bullets, proves without a shadow of a doubt that not only is he not police officer material, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0317. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0317. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out our Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes. Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.